You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host, Bill Humphrey.
For 91.3 FM, WVUD, WVUD HD1, and WVUD HD2 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. I'm coming to you on December 15th, 2014, from my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Nate joins me to discuss the torture report and the new government funding bill. Then, Nate reviews a new video game set in the 1990s Siege of Sarajevo. All that is coming up right now on Arsenal for Democracy. Arsenal for Democracy is usually recorded in studio every Monday and is available for download on Wednesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me in studio again this week is Nate. Nate, welcome back.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
We're going to start off by talking about the torture report. This is the 500-ish page executive summary released by the Senate Intelligence Committee Democratic majority this past week. And it's the executive summary of a 6,300-page report on methods used by the CIA specifically in the aftermath of September 11th before they were prevented from continuing with those methods. You know, I think that a reasonable person looking at the details released to this report would call this torture and nothing short of torture. A lot of it's been hedged as, you know, interrogation or enhanced interrogation.
Harsh interrogation or severe interrogation. I mean, it just seems like people are going out of their way, both in print and when we're talking about it, to avoid just saying the word torture, because obviously America can never torture. I mean, I don't know how that could ever happen.
Yeah, and it is important to stress that it was torture, because you get people, Republicans in Congress, cherry picking details from it to basically support to their base that this was perfectly acceptable. They'll talk about things like the stress positions and stuff like that, which A, are not great in their own right, but you can see how someone would be like, oh, well, you're just making them uncomfortable for a while. Like, that's not so bad, right? But that's, again, that's cherry picking, because there was also things like, and we knew about some of these things for actually since 2009 or earlier. For example, they waterboarded one suspect 183 times in 1 month, which mathematically almost seems impossible. And waterboarding,
it's at least a couple times a day, you know.
Yeah, so it's simulated drowning.
It's about once a breakfast, lunch, and dinner, you know, just three times a day.
And they got, as far as we know, and the internal documents have seemed to indicate for quite some time, they got essentially no useful intelligence from doing that. And also, there have been, you know, other things mentioned in this report, like the one that has been dubbed rectal feeding, which is basically sort of food paste type enemas being, you know, rammed up somebody's rear end. And they claim, oh, you know, yeah, well, we're force feeding them or something like that because they're not eating. Well, in fact, scientific research has indicated since the early 1900s that has been disputed as an actual delivery system for nutrition to the human body. So this was simply nothing short of sexual assault and arguably just straight up rape of these, you know, detainees. And again, some of them weren't even actually terrorists. They were people who were mistakenly picked up.
Yeah, Bill, I was under the impression that feeding was done in a different orifice. So just stop there.
Yeah, I mean, this report should be horrifying. I mean, even if we knew a lot of the details, well, people who are paying attention anyway, knew a lot of the details for quite a few years now, and we've known, for example, from CIA documents that had been leaked, you know, going back to 2004, 10 years ago, we've known that this didn't really, you know, produce results. We also know that decades ago, the United States knew that this wasn't the best way to get intelligence. You know, the in World War II, they had basically concluded that. We've prosecuted people in the United States Armed Forces and, you know, the Japanese Armed Forces and all that for very similar methods or the same exact methods. The 1963 CIA Field Manual says that you can often get better intelligence by being really nice to the people that you've detained and, you know, not torturing them, because torture tends to harden their resolve and get them to give you garbage intelligence, which then wastes time, you know, that you have to go track this down and try to verify it, and then it turns out it was fake, you know. So instead of, so, you know, like, we may have quote-unquote stopped some plots with this, potentially, but in all likelihood, they weren't even real plots. They were just, you know, made up. The conclusions of this report match everything we've known for decades, if not centuries, going back to witch trials, which is that these methods do not work and should not be used, that they are a bridge too far, that this is where we draw the line, and we say that if you're, you know, a human being, you don't get subjected to this treatment. Whether or not it works is honestly kind of irrelevant, but we've also known for so long that this isn't a good way. The quote-unquote ticking time bomb scenario just doesn't hold up under scrutiny here, because you're going to get better intelligence. And in fact, we've seen in recent years, especially in the last year or two, when you get people picking up like ISIS-type guys and stuff like that, a lot of times the interrogations have basically gone something like this. Hey, so, got any good plots going on? Yeah, let me tell you all about these awesome plots, because we're such badasses who've come up with these great ideas. And then they just start bragging to the, you know, federal investigators or whoever's holding them without being, you know, tortured.
What I find kind of interesting is the people that, you know, sort of defend these methods and say that this type of torture is completely acceptable. I sort of wonder, you know, where they for themselves draw the line. Like, if we were able to use thumb screws on a guy, or like stretch him out on the rack, and that would help us, you know, find the location of the ticking time bomb, would that be an acceptable method of enhanced interrogation techniques? I mean, it's not so much that, you know, these methods are or not effective. You know, theoretically, yes, if someone has a relatively weak resolve for a terrorist, maybe you could waterboard them like 100 times and then maybe they spill the beans, but there's almost a greater chance of that simply not happening, and instead you sort of are, you know, as you said, Bill, chasing the wrong leads, or just dealing with someone who, you know, does not want to break, or maybe doesn't even have that much information to begin with, and you're sort of just wasting your time pounding them into submission. And I also want to say that, okay, obviously that we're not like, you know, flaying people or doing some like weird Game of Thrones type torture, right? So this is not like necessarily medieval, but when you add everything together, so the waterboarding, the stress positions, being forced naked, being, you know, rectal feeding, being like, enclosed in a box, and there are, you know, various dog attacks, and we've seen the Abu Ghraib pictures, you know, that was not the only time that things like that happened for captives of U.S. soldiers or U.S. Interrogators. You know, I don't know if people have seen Zero Dark Thirty, but at least the interrogation scene at the beginning of that movie is at least, you know, somewhat realistic. I mean, obviously there was a lot more going on than that was shown, but I mean, it should give you at least a little bit of an idea. You know, you've got this guy strapped around, you're smacking him around, you're, you know, waterboarding him, keeping him in a box, basically. There were instances where they're playing extremely loud music, extremely low temperatures, so people are, like, shivering, unable to sleep. That's torture. When you add all those things together, that's torture. You know, maybe you just say, okay, cold temperature, not torture, just making them uncomfortable. All those things together, yeah, that constitutes, you know, unacceptable treatment under, you know, international treaties and such. So I don't think there's really too much of a debate over whether this can be considered torture at this point.
Yeah, this is definitely torture, and we also know that it didn't work, and we also know that it was used on people who had completely been picked up incorrectly. You know, they happened to be nearby somebody, that sort of thing. We know that we screwed up, essentially, and people still aren't willing to admit that, even though that is very clear. And it's been clear for a while, but this report really underscores that point. But there's a real bigger problem here, which is that there's so much focus in the U.S. debate on this, on that, did it work? You know, oh, well, if it worked, then it was justified, blah, blah, blah. But that's the thing. At the point where you've asked the question, did it work, you've already crossed a very fundamental line. You've already said, this thing that we know doesn't work and has been ruled off limits, whether or not it works, is now, we're going to bring this back because what happened was so horrible and the people who did it are so terrible that, you know, if we use it on them, that's justified, if nothing else, for revenge. And if we get the wrong people, that's okay. That's just collateral damage and acceptable losses. You know, and you know, President Obama can say, oh, well, I stopped these methods, or I made sure they wouldn't be used to get, well, they had already been stopped anyway. But regardless, we shifted, basically, the CIA itself shifted from doing these, you know, arresting people, you know, outside the legal system in some part of the world and then bringing them to a prison. We replaced that with drone strikes. And so with drone strikes, you've just said, okay, well, we're going to kill these people and not worry about...
Don't even have to ask the questions. It's fine.
Right. And we know that there have been a lot of innocent people killed in these drone strikes. And under the Obama administration, which has launched, you know, 90-some-odd percent of all of the targeted strikes since the war on terror started, we know that the official policy of the administration, as revealed in New York Times investigations, is that any military age male who is in the area and gets hit by the strike is considered to be an enemy combatant unless retroactively proved innocent by subsequent evidence.
I mean, this has sort of been U.S. policy ever since Vietnam. I mean, just bomb the hell out of the area, declare all the people who died in that area as enemy combatants, and then just wipe your hands with it and be done. You know, it doesn't matter if, you know, a 12-year-old Vietnamese kid who was not particularly hateful towards the U.S. died, as long as, you know, 100 Viet Cong also died, and then you're able to say, okay, check that off on our balance sheet on this side of the ledger for the war, and we're able to, you know, move on. And despite the fact that we have highly advanced technology now with drone strikes, it's still not pinpoint enough to, you know, determine the hearts and minds of the people that you're attacking and whether they're actually threats. And it feels like a lot of the time it's not. It's just some random person, you know, in the Pakistan mountains who maybe is carrying the AK and therefore is deemed a threat by the drone. So, you know, it's a very discouraging situation when, you know, it doesn't seem like this sort of status quo is likely to change anytime soon or in the future when it comes to drones, you know.
Yeah, and there's, in my mind, for both drone strikes and torture, you have to cross a certain line in your mind in order to come to the conclusion that this is justifiable in any way. You basically have to say, you know, whether or not these people are terrorists, whether or not they have anti-American leanings, it doesn't really matter. They no longer count. These are right. not people. They are not subject to the protections of due process. They are not subject to the protections of the rule of law. They are not, you know, covered by human rights protections. We have essentially said these people do not count, even though we have said for half a century now that we shouldn't be using these methods. We've said, never mind, ignore the fact that this was, you know, made illegal by the Reagan administration. We're just going to go ahead and use these tactics because these people don't count. And if we get the wrong people, so be it, because our lives are more important than their lives.
No, and this is American exceptionalism at its finest. And I always sort of, I don't know, say laugh or cringe whenever people talk about American exceptionalism like it's some positive thing and how, you know, America's bringing good things to the world. Well, actually, when the prime examples of American exceptionalism are, you know, believing that other country citizens are viable military targets and not subject to due process or, you know, able to be tortured, that's the kind of American exceptionalism where we wouldn't accept that from a different country, but because we're America, we can do it ourselves and really no one's going to stop us. And we can just declare it in the greater interest of our country or in a national security interest. And therefore, we can just wipe our hands of it. You know, that's the kind of American exceptionalism that gets a lot of people around the world just thinking that we simply only care about ourselves, don't care about the well-being and our relationship with others, and are, you know, this sort of callous superpower colossus that just sort of tramples around countries around the world and just leaves things broken in its wake.
Right. And also, you know, we've talked a lot about these foreign citizens, but it's now extended to the point of American citizens as well. But it's, you know, it's only a specific subset of American citizens who are involved in, you know, anti-U.S. government activities and terrorist activities, right? We, you know, we do drone strikes against, you know, Anwar al-Awlaki in Yemen, you know, a targeted assassination of an American citizen because he's involved with al-Qaeda and, you know, he's a so-called Islamic extremist, but we're not going to do, you know, drone strikes on, like, Christian extremist groups. We don't, you know, the furthest extent that we've gotten to that is doing various, you know, targeted activities against like Joseph Kony's Christian extremist faction, you know, in Central Africa. And like that also falls under a similar category of just being like, Well, certain people just don't count, you know, and certain people do count. It's a very clear, like, it's sort of a caveman style distinction of being like, well, I don't know who this group is, so yeah. I'm going to kill all of them because extremely they might tribal. Be a threat to me. Yeah. It's not the response that a 21st century superpower should be having to basically what amounts to an angry group of people who pulled off a particularly spectacular attack, but, you know, on the grand scale of the United States,
right.
did not pose all that much of a threat and were relatively easily disrupted.
And, Bill, we've talked about this before, how I wouldn't say I'm extremely supportive of drone strikes, but I am, I do view drones as sort of the wave of the future when it comes to the technological revolutions in warfare, and I believe they're sort of the next step when it comes to just having more advanced weapons and technology. But that being said, you know, there's a way to use them properly, just like there's a way to use any other weapon properly, and just sort of indiscriminately sending hellfire missiles towards various regions in Pakistan where we think some of our national enemies might be, you know, despite the consequences, that's not necessarily the best way to use them, and often an extremely counterproductive and dangerous way to use them. So, you know, I think it's worth talking about, you know, just like any sort of application of American military power, is this the way that we should be using it? Or is this, you know, should we be using it at all? Or is there a better way to use it? Or just, there's so many ways to just try to tweak our global influence in a way that's not necessary, where we can still try to look out for our interests and protect our vital interests, but at the same time, not just go around pissing everyone off that, in some ways unnecessarily, that we don't actually need to do. So it's a little frustrating sometimes.
Yeah. And I think that the you know, why people need to care about this report is because at the heart of it, you know, the response that we had both among, you know, ordinary people and, you know, U.S. government employees at quite high levels, the response that we had to 9/11 was this, like I said, this sort of just caveman tribal style
fear.
Reaction, yeah. this fear reaction that we need to be better than. And more importantly, it's not like 9/11 was this, you know, such a gigantic anomaly that we couldn't possibly conceive, like that if anybody had done it, we would have reacted the same way. No, we reacted in a very specific way because the people that we believed were responsible, you know, correctly believed were responsible, happened to come from a very different community. They came from a different religious community, or at least identified in it from a different religious community, even if they didn't represent that. They come from a different, you know, ethnicity than the majority in the United States. And I honestly think there's a very close parallel between, you know, using torture, using drone strikes, and police brutality stuff that we see in the United States, these justifiable killings from the police and these sort of vigilante killings with stand your ground cases, like with, you know, Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman, right? That we're basically seeing this response where the lives of some become so privileged and so, you know, that they have to be protected at all costs, that we literally say, all these other people, even if they aren't a threat, even if they haven't committed acts of terrorism, even if they wouldn't dream of doing it, but they happened to be in the wrong place and somebody felt threatened. They said, I felt threatened. That's the same thing that we hear both, you know, in justifying the actions after 9/11, as well as why somebody, you know, a police officer shoots someone. Even though if you look at the statistics, in the year 2013, only 6 law enforcement officers in the entire United States were killed while attempting to make an arrest, right? Obviously, we want that number to be 0, but 6 is a very, very small number relative to the entire, you know, size of America's police forces. And yet we get this constant refrain of police officers saying that they shot an unarmed person while they were trying to arrest them or having a conversation or whatever because I felt threatened. And that is then written off as saying that's justifiable. The same thing with the stand your ground laws. If you look at the sample text, like, for example, the Michigan law that was passed in 2006, that's a pretty stereotypical one. It literally says that you're allowed to use deadly force if you reasonably believe that doing so is the only way to prevent bodily harm or fatality to you or someone else in your immediate vicinity, right? That you don't have to try to de-escalate the situation and get out of the situation. You can use lethal force to just end this thing. And then your justification is, well, I had a reasonable belief that I was threatened. And that's the problem. You can't say that in response to these events. You especially can't say it on behalf of the entire United States government, but you also can't say it when it's weirdly only directed at certain people. in the case of police officer shootings of unarmed people, I think it's something like 51% of all the victims are in recent years have been either Black or Latino, even though the U.S. is 72% white. And
actually, 51 seems low.
Right. But, you know, like the obviously that means there's a lot of white people also getting killed by police. But relative to the population, it's not proportional at all. Right. And then you got, you know, we're going around just killing, you know, these so-called Islamic extremist terrorists, you know, Arab people or Pakistanis or whatever, or Yemenis, Somalis, but we're not, you know, using these tactics on various other, you know, ethnicities of extremist groups, including U.S. extremist groups. We have these white Christian extremists in the United States, you know, they're part of white supremacist movements, etc., and we don't use these tactics on them. We don't use these tactics on, you know, white criminals casing neighborhoods all the time. We don't use these tactics on, you know, people that we, oh, well, I felt threatened by that white guy who actually had a gun. I mean, it's like how you got, you know, in the span of a few months, you got John Crawford III and Tamir Rice, you know, a 22-year-old or so guy and a 12-year-old kid, both holding toy guns, and the police killed them in seconds without warning in an open carry state where white people are legally allowed to carry around guns, and the police don't immediately, you know, shoot them down saying, oh, I thought this person was a threat. There's a very, very primordial tribalization going on here that is saying, oh, well, you know, if you look like us, then you're way less of a threat automatically than, you know, Black people, Latino people, Arab people, you know, Pakistanis of various ethnicities, and we've completely decategorized it and said these people are human, so they get one set of treatments, and these people are not human. They are literally not human, and so they get a completely different set of treatment that, you know, basically harkens back to that sort of founding fathers attitude of being like, well, let's see, slaves are going to count as 3/5 of a person, 60% of a person, right? They don't get all of the same qualifications of being a person, so there's an entirely different rule set that applies to them. It's the same thing. This response that we had after 9/11 is functionally equivalent to the Reconstruction era response of white Southerners saying, well, if we don't go around killing Black people, you know, because they either we think they're attacking our women, or we think that later they're going to, you know, challenge us for control of the power structure or whatever. If we don't go and kill them right now, they're going to, you know, kill us later or something like that, right? It's the same response. This droning, this torturing, this, you know, justifiable homicide in American streets, this all basically adds up to a white supremacist policy that's all veiled under this, well, I felt scared, I felt threatened, what was I supposed to do? How else could I have responded to this situation? I don't know, literally any other way.
One point I would just like to make is in regard to this sort of, I feel like it's a growing Islamophobia. Just after 9/11, you know, there were some instances of it, but it didn't feel as bad as it has been recently. And even though I felt like things played into some preconceived notions of Muslims, whether it was, you know, the Intifada, the first World Trade Center terrorist bombing, or various hijackings. So there was like a cultural background there for people to draw on as, you know, Arabs equal terrorists. And then from there, I didn't feel like it was too bad for the first couple years after the war, after 9/11, but after like a decade of both the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan, I felt that like almost hardened people's attitudes, if that makes any sense. Like maybe people that knew people that were fighting over there and then came back with sort of, you know, attitudes or influence other people with attitudes like visceral fighting, you know, in the middle of combat, and, you know, sort of take that sort of those sort of feelings with you. And then we've seen just like an outbreak of Islamophobia in the United States, where it seems like every mosque that's being built in anywhere but, like, I don't know, Massachusetts is like subject to threats and arson attempts and, you know, protests. We saw with the One World Trade Center mosque in New York. And, you know, it just seems like there's just a growing, just a viewpoint that it's almost too dangerous to sort of trust Muslims or let them, you know, just exist normally in society. And I guess extending your point to, you know, the recent outbreak of police shootings, it almost seems like they view, okay,
12-year-old kid on a playground with a toy gun, too dangerous because he's black, you know, no time to, like, stop and ask questions. Too dangerous, shoot first, ask questions later. And, you know, you have to wonder, and I don't think there's too much wondering going on, is if this is a 12-year-old white kid with a, you know, water pistol, does he get the same treatment? Probably not. So
it almost just, assuredly yeah, not. No. I think we can probably speak to that from our childhood experiences. Cop was ever going to stop us for carrying around a toy gun.
Yeah, exactly. So it's just, you know, and I don't know what, like, the colors on that toy gun are, but, like, unless it was, like, 100% realistic, like, I don't know what the hell is going on there, because you just shot a kid. Like, I don't think they, unless you seriously thought the kid was, like, about to murder someone. And
they tried to say that the playground was filled with kids. I watched the surveillance video. There is no one else on the playground when the cops arrived. It's just this one kid.
And I saw a video of a guy in a Walmart who was, like, carrying around a toy gun.
That's John Crawford that I mentioned earlier.
Cops came in and just shot him before he even looked at them. Like, he was down immediately.
Yeah. He didn't have time to turn around or
and
anything.
And I think there was, like, and it was some, and this is the thing that always gets me, is, like, when, like, the tape gets released of, like, the 911 call, and it's always some old white, like, either old white woman or, like, some crusty old man.
In the case of the Walmart one, the guy who called was a guy who literally had been kicked out of the Marines for false statements. Like, he had a huge history of basically being a pathological liar, and he lied and called 911 and said that this guy...
He was pointing at children, which I don't think on the video I ever saw that happen, so...
He doesn't do anything like that, and the guy, you know, the witness has basically
had to
recount his
statements.
He's,
like, carrying around, like, talking on a cell phone or something, not even paying attention to what's going on, so... I mean,
yeah, he was just standing there or whatever. And then the police tried to come up with a theory that he was planning to go and murder his children and their mother and stuff like that. And they tried to bully his, you know, his current girlfriend about coming up with a theory that he was actually planning to go murder her or something. And it was just like, it was so crazy. I mean, these frame up jobs, it's like with that drones policy of saying, you know, unless there's evidence retroactively proving you innocent, then you're considered to have been a threat and an enemy combatant.
Bill, if you want to read some more, like, terrifying police stories, just, like, look into, like, really any drug raid. Pretty much, like, the dog will get killed immediately. There was one instance where they threw a flashbang into a child's crib and left him with a hole in his heart. You know, multiple instances of just, like, breaking down the wrong person's door and then, like, you know, maybe it was the grandma gets her door broken in, but the guy next door was the one, you know, growing drugs or whatever. So, you know, you've got grandma terrified half to death. Guy picks up a pistol to defend himself because why are these armed men breaking into my house? And, of course, he gets shot. You know, you're just litanies of these. And, you know, it's just, it seems like there's a growing militarization of the police in America. And, you know, as we're talking about drones, soon they'll have drones. I mean, the state government here in Massachusetts already has drones. I mean, sometimes just to look at the reservoir, but, you know, how long will it be towards until, like, maybe the police in Texas or something get their own military type drones in order to enforce the law? So who knows what's going to happen? And I mean, for all the stick we give the U.S. military about its drone policies, at least the people that are flying those drones are, like, you know, usually relatively trained, at least in terms of flying them and operating them, maybe not so much in gathering intelligence on the ground. That would lead you to use them effectively, but I don't trust at all, like, a random police officer to be able to use a drone effectively. And, you know, one has to wonder about the kind of controls that will be given to those types of weapons. I mean, police forces have, like, armored APCs, like, it'll be tanks next, you know, so, you know, what's next?
All right. Well, there's obviously so much more we could talk about here, you know, and we've been writing a lot about it on arsenalfordemocracy.com. You can also go back and read posts from me and Nate going back to 2009 on this topic, because this has been taking quite a while, because the CIA literally was so convinced they had to stop this report being released that they hacked the computers of the Senate Intelligence Committee, which is the committee tasked with overseeing the CIA. And if that doesn't raise red flags for everyone, including defenders of quote-unquote, you know, enhanced interrogation, you know, the fact that they were hacking their own overseeing committee is a very serious threat
for the CIA.
But it's a very serious threat to our democracy.
Well, yeah, well, they don't really support our democracy, so that's okay.
All right. Well, we are going to come back with more topics in just a moment from Arsenal for Democracy. Stick around for that. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Still in studio with me is Nate. We're going to talk now about the Continuing Resolution Omnibus, also known as the Cromnibus, which was the giant $1.1 trillion funding package that the House of Representatives and Senate passed last week and over the weekend. And this was supported by the White House, and it's going to keep the government from shutting down. We're going to go over some of the negative provisions because I want to talk about the question of at what point Democrats, whether in Congress or the White House, should probably not support things like this. So here are some things that were included in this huge funding package. Rollbacks to the Dodd-Frank financial reform package that was passed back in 2010. Those provisions were literally written by lobbyists from Citigroup. That's according to the New York Times. And it also is significantly changing campaign finance rules. There's going to be, you're going to be able to now give, well over $200,000 more to each individual Senate or House campaign. You know, right now it's a much, much lower limit each cycle. There's going to be budget cuts to the Environmental Protection Agency, the Securities and Exchange Commission, you know, basically making it even harder for those regulators to do their jobs and prevent various, you know, companies from breaking the law. There's also going to be, it's going to be easier to cut pension agreements for current retirees, not future retirees, but current retirees. And the CEO of JP Morgan, Jamie Dimon, was literally on Capitol Hill, I believe, according to the Huffington Post, personally whipping House votes for the funding bill, which in my mind kind of says a lot about what's everything that's wrong with this bill.
Or our government.
That's true, too. And also, perhaps most egregiously, although a lot of people, I guess, would consider it a minor provision, is that it is giving away sacred Apache land in a protected national forest in Arizona to an Australian mining company for copper mining.
Excellent. Just a great use of land and money.
Yeah, I'm not really sure what the point of protecting
the
national forest is.
Yeah, go right to the protected national forest and the Apache sacred burial grounds and whatnot. I hear that's where the best copper mines are, so just get start extracting.
Yeah, I mean, that's apparently literally the argument that they're using for doing this.
I mean, you can't shift where the copper is, Bill.
You could just not screw over Native Americans.
I don't.
Though, yeah.
I mean, let's get real. How many Apache are still living on those lands that could like actually have a say about it? You know.
Well, that's part of the problem. They've all been moved to
power.
The reservations.
Yeah, so
yeah, and this is not on the reservation.
They pretty much do whatever they want at this point. So.
Yeah, and I bring up stuff like that because it's very frustrating to see, you know. You know, people seem to think that, you know, all the Native Americans are gone or that, you know, the Native Americans were treated badly, but now it's all fine. Like, it's clearly not. And we've talked about this previously on the show. This is yet another just giant slap in the face to people who have already suffered so much at the hands of the government. The United States government is basically supposed to be taking care of them at this point because of how badly they have been treated by the U.S. government and the United States as a whole. And this is yet another example of the U.S. government failing to do that. And even the Interior Secretary said that she was profoundly disappointed by this provision. The Bureau of Indian Affairs falls under the Department of the Interior, as does the public land that's in question through the Bureau of Land Management, I believe. But it's just, it's so frustrating to see this kind of thing still happening every year, multiple times a year, just the government finding some new way to screw over Native Americans.
Well, the thing is, it's a relatively constant state of basically, I guess you could say, screwing over Native Americans, or just, I mean, if you look at some of the statistics about poverty rates on reservations and in Native American communities, and you look at the rates of sexual violence, where something like one third of all Native American women are likely to be sexually abused at some point. And then you look at, okay, why is this? There's literally no police force in some areas, or the police force has to cover so many, you know, square miles. You know, we're often talking about out west, where it's, you know, relatively sparse population, that there's effectively no law enforcement anywhere. And then you get into some of the disagreements over jurisdiction and things like that, and you know, the native organizations are not funded well enough, and they're not, you know, developed well enough, and then the police
from the, you know, local authorities don't necessarily care, not going out of their way to protect Native Americans. So it just creates a situation where, you know, any sort of, you know, attempt by, you know, various departments of the Interior or the Native American Affairs Bureau of, you know, quote unquote, protecting Native Americans really ring hollow after just sort of a lack of funding and effort. And then on top of this, just straight up stealing their land and giving them to profitable mining consortiums.
Yeah, it's very disturbing. I also just, I can't believe that the White House got behind a bill. I mean, I can believe it, but you know what I'm saying? That the White House got behind a bill that removes some of the key enforcement provisions, the few teeth that were in the Dodd-Frank bill at all that, you know, the president worked so hard to get through in the first place. And somehow, you know, they're just like, well, we can't possibly let the government shut down again. And it's like, I don't know, where are we ever going to draw the line anymore on what we include in these bills just to get a deal? I mean, at what point do you stop letting the super crazy people take control of everything in the whole process? At what point do you say, no, this is it. This is the end of the line. We went along with this for a while, but just no more.
Yeah, I have to wonder if maybe some of the previous federal government shutdown and fiscal cliff type conflicts have maybe made the Obama administration a little gun-shy into having that sort of thing happen again.
But they barely fought on those either.
Well, I mean, exactly. But, you know, this is kind of, I would say it's kind of a little par for the course of the Obama administration about, you know, 6 years in or whatever. They're sort of, they've displayed some reluctance to sort of get stuck in on pretty contentious political battles for some time now. So, I mean, what political issue have they really gotten stuck in on since Obamacare? Yeah. So, it's a little discouraging.
I don't know what this administration stands for. I don't know what the Democratic Party stands for. It's my party. I'd like to know what it stands for.
Oh, well, at least we know what some members of the party stand for, but as a collective, I think we're going back to the, what is it, that line, like, I'm not a member of a organized political party, I'm a Democrat. Like, that sort of thing. Like, what are we doing here? Like, the Republicans don't have an agenda either, but we're not exactly doing too much, you know, on ourselves. So it's
like, this is one of the, this is, you know, aside from quote-unquote Obamacare, this was one of the signature pieces of legislation from the Obama administration. And then we're just going to be like, well, never mind.
Yeah. Well,
like, what's been the point of any of this?
Well, I mean, to be fair, Dodd-Frank had been eviscerated some aspects of it from the start by the banks.
I know. It barely was a law.
Yeah. So, at least we haven't crashed again yet.
Yeah, but that's,
I think we
the
have
same
to wait to build up a little more before we can crash.
Sure, that's the same logic, though, that says that because there haven't been another 9/11, that this all the CIA did must have worked. That's the same logic. It's like, well, those are unrelated facts. All right, we'll be back in just a moment with another segment here from arsenalfordemocracy.com. Stick around. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey, and still in studio with me is Nate. We're going to go now to our political pop culture segment, which we very occasionally do on this show. We're going to be talking about a new video game. It was released in November on Steam for Mac, Windows, and Linux, and it is called This War of Mine. And Nate played through this game, and he posted a review on arsenalfordemocracy.com if you want to read that review, but we're also going to talk about the game right now. So, Nate, what is the setting for this game?
Yeah, I would say it's, I don't know if it's explicitly in Sarajevo, but it's sort of based on the Siege of Sarajevo in the 90s, and you play as a group of sort of civilians that are, you know, by day inhabiting this almost like large house, like apartment building. You're sort of safe in there. And then by night, you're sort of sneaking out to try to find various resources amongst like various abandoned buildings or military outposts or, you know, like hotels that have been inhabited by, you know, armed groups and stuff like that. So, you know, it's very dangerous. You're trying not to get yourself killed as you're going out and trying to find vital supplies. And, you know, it's an extremely sort of, I describe it as almost like Minecraft mixed with this game called the Mark of the Ninja, which is sort of like a stealth-based exploration game. So it's, there are two, I would say, distinct elements. One, of course, being the sneaking around, trying to avoid various armed patrols, things like that, or hostile civilians who might try to kill you, and gathering, you know, the medicine, the food. You need to get wood, various spare parts to construct, you know, the things that you need at your house to, you know, make your quality of life better and survive longer. And then, you know, during the day, you know, you're trying to feed all your guys, trying to barter with the people that come to your door. You're trying to board up your windows so robbers won't get in during the night. You're trying to make weapons so, you know, if the robbers do get in, you can defend yourselves. You're just trying to increase your general happiness and quality of life. So, like, sometimes your characters might get upset or sad if you're, like, screwing over the people that come offering, like, they want help. So, like, if they ask for your help, you know, your character, one of your characters might go away for a night, but, you know, everyone else will be happier because you actually helped that neighbor out. Whereas if you refuse, they start getting mad, and then, you know, combine that with hunger, they might start committing suicide. I've read that happens sometimes. So, you know, you sort of have to balance the happiness and, you know, the various resource demands that you have. I've read about, and I didn't necessarily do this myself, but people just like committing atrocities and just like slaughtering, you know, people that are living at the house nearby in order to steal their supplies, things like that. So basically, as I'd say, the game sort of puts you in this extremely complex moral landscape where, you know, you need to survive, but you also don't want to hurt others, you know, too badly that live nearby you. But I guess at some point for some people, the necessities of survival basically force you to do that. So, you know, it's a game that has like a tremendous emotional impact, I would say, just between the graphics and the soundtrack is almost haunting in some ways. I basically played this game for like 5 hours straight upon first getting it, and, you know, just went back to it over the next couple weeks and was consistently playing it. So I would definitely recommend getting it if anyone's interested in this, you know, kind of game. It's a very specific type of game, so it's not like a game maybe everyone would enjoy, but I would say it's worthwhile just to like experience this and sort of try to figure out how to survive in this sort of war zone.
Now, how does a game like this compare to, you know, some of the sort of trendier, you know, AAA titles that we see really popular these days, your, you know, zombie apocalypse types games, your Call of Duties?
Yeah.
What's the kind of distinction there?
Yeah, I would say this is more of a, it's not a, really an action game. Like my really only complaint is like sometimes it's too hard to defend yourselves against the various bandits that might be trying to kill you. Or at least I never figured out quite how to do that with like an assault rifle or something. But really the entire thing is you're constantly thinking about how to best utilize your resources and how to best find those resources so you can exploit them. So you think about, okay, I need like this amount of parts because I'm trying to build a moonshine still and then like produce moonshine and then be able to trade it for like medicine or something. So these are the kind of things you're thinking about rather than just like, okay, I'm going to go around this corner and shoot all these guys and then just like run forward and do whatever, which I feel like most war games nowadays are about. And this is much more of a strategy type game where you're just trying to optimize the chances of survival for your characters. And I should note, many of these characters have like different amounts of space for things they can hold. Some are faster than others, some are better cooks. They have a different personality, so you sort of have to manage that as well a little bit. And yeah, I mean, there are a couple instances I'll just share some of my experiences in the game. Like, for example, I was asked by like a neighbor to come raid a supply crate with him, and there was a bunch of supplies in there, and obviously we were able to split the supplies. Then the police, or like a military police, came by my door and was like, we've noticed that a supply crate was been raided, and if you have any information, we'll give you, you know, food, cigarettes, all this stuff. And so you were asked to make the choice of whether you wanted to rat out your, you know, friend of yours, potentially anger some of the other characters in your group and get all the supplies, or just sort of ignore that and let those supplies be. You know, in another instance, sort of demonstrates the sort of tough choices you have to make. But I had extra medicine, and there was an old man
and a son who needed medicine for the old man who was sick. So I went over to their house, bartered the medicine, got a lot of food, and then went down to their basement and, like, unlocked their various fridges down there and stole some of their stuff just because, I mean, I actually needed that. Like, I needed their assault rifle. I had no weapons and stuff. So sometimes you just got to do what you have to do. And, you know, that sort of demonstrates the tough choices that occasionally you'll have to make. Obviously, I didn't have to do that, but there comes points where you've, like, gotten all the necessary supplies or the critical supplies in certain areas. Some other areas are cut off. You can't go to them because there's too much fighting in the area, and that really, like, limits your options. And so I'd say after, like, 20 or 30 days, resources start becoming scarce, and then that just, like, increases the tough moral choices you have to make. So, I mean, it's a challenging game. It's not easy in any way. So, you know, that's just one of the things I'd point out about it.
Yeah, now to, you know, recap, as we mentioned at the top of the segment, this game called This War of Mine, which is from a European video game company, and I think they had a lot of involvement from people who had actually lived through this, the Siege of Sarajevo. That siege lasted 3 years, 10 months, 3 weeks, and 3 days, according to Wikipedia. It lasted from April 92 to February 96. Just horrible conditions, lots of sort of fighting happening all over the city, you know, in the outside of the city and all that, in Bosnia, and it was eventually kind of put a stop to that because of the Dayton agreements in the United States that sort of at least temporarily cooled things down enough to end the siege. I think the obvious parallel that we're looking at right now in our contemporary times is probably the ongoing sieges in places like Aleppo in Syria, these areas that have been under siege since, you know, 2012 in some cases, and are widely anticipated to continue for probably at least another year or two before I would say, in my estimation, the inevitable victory of the government in most of these areas. And we've also seen some of the smaller cities that had been under siege, that these sieges were eventually lifted through very localized agreements brokered by the United Nations. I've written about that at arsenalfordemocracy.com in the past. But basically, in those situations, the government temporarily pulls back because everything has been destroyed. And in many cases, from what I've been reading from various sources inside Syria, in places like Al Monitor and stuff, they have correspondents there, often anonymous for their protection. You have actual people rising up against the rebel factions controlling their cities because they have run out of food and their cities have been destroyed, and they would rather have the government come back in at that point than continue under a state of siege. So kind of thinking about your experiences playing through this game, you know, are we going to be kind of hearing similar stuff coming out of Syria after this war is over, after we hear people recounting their experiences of living through that?
Yeah, I mean, I would expect there's got to be all sorts of really tragic stories that would, you know, whether we hear all of them or not is a different thing. But, you know, just anytime you have protracted sieges, you know, this food resource can be scarce, and, you know, you have people basically doing terrible things to each other to achieve those, you know, supplies. So, you know, you have to fear for that. Now, just the main thing I got out of this game, and I think other people would get out of it too, is just allow you to think more about sort of the ordinary people that are existing and surviving in a war zone. So, you know, you have, like, anytime you think about a war, you have, you know, your image of your mind of the various soldiers, you know, huddled behind like a barrier or something, or like squads, you know, fighting street to street. So that's sort of what you think about when you think about a war zone. But what you don't really think about is, like, the person in the building next to those soldiers that are fighting, and they're, like, huddled in the basement, and, like, you know, shells are going on overhead, or, you know, they hear the firing outside, and, you know, they've barely got enough food and water to survive, but they're trying to scrape things together and, like, sneaking out at night, risking life and limb in order to, like, find more supplies, and sometimes getting killed in the process. So, I mean, those are the kind of stories that are ultimately, in many ways, more compelling than, you know, just your ordinary soldier going around shooting other people, despite, you know, many compelling stories amongst those too. But, you know, the ordinary civilians trying to survive is extremely interesting. And, you know, some of the things, you know, they have, like, built-in stories for some of these characters, and, like, depending what you do with them over the course of the game, you know, there is an endpoint to the game, which I have not reached yet because, you know, it's extremely difficult in some cases, but, and also don't know how long that would take, and, like, it just goes day by day, so it
maybe 3 years.
Yeah, you never know. And, you know, they talk about, I think there's one character who was like, oh, like, after the war, this character, I think it was like Pavel, is he, because of his traumatic experiences during the conflict, he became like addicted to hard drugs and like overdosed and died several years after the war. So it's like, and then, you know, maybe if other outcomes are different, if they have better outcomes during the game, maybe, you know, he doesn't do that. But it just sort of like demonstrates the way that war can impact these people, you know, even after the war, or, you know, how this changes them during the war. Maybe they start out relatively happy, jovial, and then, you know, if you don't feed them enough and they're unhappy, you know, 3 weeks in, they hang themselves. So, I mean, these are just kind of the tragic scenarios that happen during these kind of conflict. And the main thing I like about this game is it sort of allows you to play them out, you know, in a simulation type environment, but one that feels extremely high stakes and realistic, because you sort of get a little bit invested in these characters. You don't want them to starve to death, and you're sort of constantly running around trying to prevent that. So,
right, removing the abstractions from the civilian side of war.
Yeah, and it's extremely in detail. So, you know, whether it's you're collecting tobacco and you're trying to like put those ingredients together to create cigarettes to use as currency, and then use that to, you know, get food or medicine if one of your people are getting sick. You know, you have to build a furnace and keep things warm to make sure people don't get sick from the cold. There's like some saves, like you'll just start the game and it'll be during winter, so it'll just be way colder than normal. It'll be like 0 degrees Celsius as a base point, so you have to build like 5 furnaces. You know, you just create these scenarios where, you know, you're struggling against both the elements and the danger outside of the building, and just creates these scenarios where, you know, it creates an interesting game. So it's not like the most in-depth extreme game that you'll ever encounter, but I'd say it's worth at least getting. It's pretty cheap, only $20, and worth playing through as much as you want, because it can be extremely addictive and an interesting game.
Yeah, and that game is, again, as we mentioned, available for $20 through Steam. That's steampowered.com from 11-bit Studios, based out of Poland. And this is This War of Mine, based at least loosely on the Siege of Sarajevo in the Bosnia War in the 1990s. All right, well, Nate, thank you so much for reviewing this game and for being on the show today to talk about all of these issues.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
That's all the time we have this week. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Wednesdays. You can also hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD, WVUD HD1, and WVUD HD2 Newark every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Special thanks to my voiceover man, Justin. You can follow his work at the Digitized Ramblings of an 8-Bit Animal from 8BitAnimal.com. You can get additional commentary at ArsenalForDemocracy.com daily, as well as links to articles discussed today. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.